The News Dissector with Danny Schechter, Fridays at 1 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hey there, Danny Schechter, your News Dissector here. Another week, another show on Progressive Radio Network, PRN.FM. I'm Danny Schechter. I write the NewsDissector.net blog. That's our new URL, NewsDissector.net. I also edit MediaChannel1.org. These are new URLs, MediaChannel1.org. I'm a blogger. I'm a writer. I'm a filmmaker and a bit of a troublemaker, and I'm here every week at this time to talk about some of the issues that I'm raising online or in print, and also offering you an opportunity to join us on the line. The phone number here, 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. This week, we're having a bit of an economic salon. We're having two brilliant writers who are writing about the economy, various aspects of it, who are going to be joining us. In the first half hour, you'll meet Barry James Dyke. He has written The Pirates of Manhattan 2, Highway to Serfdom. It's a brilliant book filled with documentary evidence and information that's not really being reported almost anywhere else. Barry lives in New Hampshire, is going to be on the phone with us in a few minutes, and I think you'll find this very worthwhile sticking around for. After after we talk with Barry, we're going to meet Gary Weiss. Gary Weiss is, you know, a brilliant financial journalist. He's been writing for Portfolio. He's been writing for a number of different places as a columnist. He has his own website. He's written for the New York Times Magazine, Parade Magazine, Condé Nast, a Portfolio, investigative reporter for Business Week. He knows his stuff, but he's taken a new tack here. He's done a profile, an analytical profile of Ayn Rand in a book called Ayn Rand Nation, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. Gary Weiss is also featured in my film Plunder, The Crime of Our Time at plunderthecrimeofourtime.com. He's somebody who knows about financial crime. He knows about financial issues. But here he's looking at a person, Ayn Rand, who he credits as sort of the philosopher queen of the right wing in America, the woman whose books, The Fountainhead, Atlas Shrugged, have helped shape a discourse, a narrative of selfishness as the core value of our economic realities. And he's going to explain all this to us when he joins us on the phone at 1:30. So, Gary Weiss at 1:30, Barry James Dyke coming up in a few minutes. You're listening to News Dissector Radio here on PRN-FM.
To chase and to Wachovia, Wells Fargo, Sally Mae, to MasterCard and Citibank, and also B of A. American Express and Visa, Morgan Stanley too. In debt we trust, so pay we must, we
joining me as well, Catherine Waters, once more. Welcome back from Switzerland.
Thank you,
Catherine was there, and she's going to have some announcements for us about some events that you might want to attend here in New York City, connected to or inspired by, if you will, the Occupy movement. You'll hear more about that in a minute. But when you go to this book, Pirates of Manhattan, a self-published volume by Barry James Dyke. Barry James Dyke is a financial analyst. He's somebody who works in the industry. He knows about the industry. If you look at his book, on the back cover, he runs a company called Castle Asset Management. On the back cover, there's a picture of Barry on a boat. Maybe it's his boat. I don't know, off the coast of New Hampshire, I assume, looking very happy. But if you read this book, you will not be very happy, because it basically tells us how our banks and financial institutions are stealing our savings, are in cahoots with all kinds of special interests. Welcome to the program, Barry. I'm so happy to have you on again, and also to read this new volume, which I'm working my way through, The Hijacking of America's Savings with Target Date Mutual Funds and What to Do About It, The Pirates of Manhattan 2, Highway to Serfdom. This is quite brilliant and took a lot of work.
Well, thank you, Danny, and it's wonderful to be with the news sector, and hats off to you as well with your efforts. And yeah, the book is it's already sold in 45 states, Canada, Europe, and you know, and I haven't even put it on Amazon yet, Danny, but it's selling real briskly, and people love it.
Just as a context for it, I want to read to you a little bit from Gary Weiss's book on Ayn Rand.
By the way.
Pardon me?
I'm a fan of Gary Weiss's.
Yeah, Ayn Rand Nation. And he's talking here about the financial crisis and its aftermath. And he writes, you know, yet the failure of deregulation and untrammeled capitalism doesn't seem to matter anymore. What followed the financial crisis was not reform, but retrenchment, rebuttal, denial. Led by Jamie Dimon, the outspoken chief executive of J.P. Morgan Chase, Wall Street struck back against the very idea of reining in its compensation and any curbs on its ability to freely transact business, regardless of societal consequences. Little reform was enacted, and what was passed into law was undermined in Congress. Even talking about such things, blaming bankers for the things they had done, was to be condemned. Well, that's part of the context, because what you've come out with here is so much new information, more information about, in a way, a crime against the American people that's ongoing. That's continuing, that involves a massive transfer of funds and theft. Give us a little summary of your argument in The Pirates of Manhattan, and I have quite a few questions for you.
Well, I think it's a greater crime. Danny, as you know, people, centuries, thousands of years ago, the pharaohs convinced people to be slaves who sacrificed their lives to build them pyramids, and I think it was a crime. But I think the crime today, using American savings plans through IRAs and 401ks, is crime even greater than that. And what they've done, Danny, is that the money has been transferred to large asset managers, and they in turn transfer buy shares of companies like Merrill Lynch, or, you know, I call it Shank of America, or whatever.
Shank of America. I like that. Make a note of that, please, Matt, for future reference on our program. The Shank of America. Very good phrase there. Go ahead.
You know, so what they do is that so what has happened is that the asset managers, whether it be the larger major mutual fund companies or it could be Bank of America, they actually could be playing multiple roles in this. They get a fee off the asset management. All the insiders loot the companies, and then who ends up holding the bag, Danny? It's the poor guy. It's the little guy who gave them the $500 a month or $1,000 a month, and it's tragic.
You write in this book, you know, there's a right. Really, on page 3, we get jumping right into this. And you have a headline here, an orgy of deal-making and lavish compensation. I'm just going to read a little of it so that people get a sense of you as a writer and the issues that you deal with here. You know, you don't mince around about it. You don't beat around the bush. You get right down into it. Today, you write, British, French, and German banks own U.S. asset management firms. U.S. banks own British credit card companies. General Electric, through GE Capital, is in reality one of the world's largest unregulated banks that also sells television broadcast services, microwaves, jet engines, medical equipment, and nuclear reactors. GE Capital owns British subprime mortgage companies and has owned stakes in Turkish banks and large consumer finance units in Japan. There's a revolving door, you write, between Washington, Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, Ivy League academia, and bankers from the Eurozone. What an orgy. Mergers and acquisitions, banks acquiring banks, investment banks acquiring mortgage brokers, banks acquiring asset managers, private equity leverage buyout shops, buying companies with no money down, trillions of derivatives. This sounds almost like poetry, but a poetry that, you know, once you penetrate it and sort of know what all these words are about, you're outraged by it. And what we're seeing here and what you're documenting here is that Wall Street doesn't want an informed public, okay? They want people uninformed so they can manipulate them. In the meantime, they can lose tremendous amounts of money, write down losses of various kinds, and people can't even comprehend it because it dribbles out in the newspapers, you know, in the back of the newspapers, in the business news. You know, you don't really get a full picture of it. You have a little chart here, okay? Write-downs and losses in billions of dollars. Citigroup, $112.2 billion. Wachovia, $101.9 billion. Bank of America, $69.6 billion. Merrill Lynch, $55.9 billion. HBS AG, $53.1 billion, et cetera, et cetera, and so forth. And you, all this adds up to, you know, over, well over $1 trillion. How can this go on like this without not only people not doing anything about it, but people not even knowing about it?
Well, you know, as you know, to the media and the banks, I'm kind of like a skunk at a summer picnic.
A skunk at a summer picnic. Okay. Keep it coming here, Barry. I like that,
you know,
too. Okay.
That's what it is. But the tragedy of all this, Danny, these are the same people who want to manage a 401k. And guess what? They've got the business. They've got the business. And no one's saying anything about it.
I mean, I wish I could be talking about someone else. I mean, you know, when I was at ABC News, of course, we had a, you know, quote, retirement fund, and, you know, we got statements and all the rest of it. And what, you know, as I read your book here, I realize that the media itself as corporate entities are really part of it. And this is one of the things I wanted you to talk about here. I mean, we know about the lobbying and the corruption, if you will. But, you know, what we don't know and what you're introducing here as an idea in a chapter that I found fascinating, because you talk about truth decay, not tooth decay, but truth decay, that the media itself is totally mad. There's a quote in your book, I think it's from Nicolas Sarkozy, the now president of France. What is that quote?
That was when he said, are we operating in a market economy or a madhouse? And we're operating in a madhouse. And, you know, and the tragedy of this, Danny, is that the media itself, you know, and it's all public documents in there. And I'm talking about, you know, Disney and CBS. And
New York Times, Washington Post.
All the usual suspects, they're all embedded with this stuff.
So, in other words, it's possible that one reason why we're not getting honest financial journalism and reporting is because these people are part of the problem. They're connected to the problem. They front for the people who are making the money. They're PR firms, in essence, not journalists. They're actually reporting on their masters, so to speak. And, and stories about what's really happening to ordinary Americans is buried. Let me give you an example. Page A20 of the New York Times, Miami, but there's no date on it, so this could have been written who knows when, okay? Lizette Alvarez is writing, said, in a recession-racked country where dour economic news abounds, the situation keeps getting grimmer. Four cities in Miami-Dade County are bearing some of the deepest cuts in the country in federal housing money designated for non-profit groups, okay, that serve the poor, the elderly, and the developmentally disabled. Several of the group's directors said they had no choice but to turn more poor people away at a time when services are in greater demand. Layoffs are also likely, they say. Miami has seen a drop to 4.9 million from 7.5 million. Who's making these cuts? Our federal government, Mr. Obama's administration. They're trying to save money, and who are they saving it on the backs of but the poor? So while people at the top end of the curve, the 1% or the 1% of the 1%, are doing really well, the 99%, the people who are the most neediest, who have the most needs, are the people getting hurt the most. But I want you to take us into your overview of for-profit media. Give us a little summary of what you found here when you looked at the media as a business, and then let's connect that to why truth may be hidden in America, because this is an area that the media, of course, doesn't examine. They don't tell you, you know, who owns them or whose interests they serve. They claim to be serving your interest as the reader or viewer. But it's go ahead.
Yeah, well, Danny, I think we talked about this about a year ago, and the great realization is that the media companies, in the old days, Danny, when business owners had some ownership, they had some skin in the game, they're run as respectable companies. But now all these companies today are owned by institutional investors. And who are the large institutional investors? Are mutual funds. So the mutual funds really are, they're horrific stewards of, they're very, very poor stewards, almost non-existent. And so you have that dysfunction right to begin with. Then you have who are the largest, this is from according to Kantar Media of New York, is that who are the largest advertisers in the media today are essentially the largest ones are like automobile companies. So we get, and actually that's the federal government because we've bailed out GM. But then you have the phone companies, and then you have the asset managers and the banks and so forth. So the media companies have a very codependent, dysfunctional relationship with all this stuff. It's disgusting. And so not only the
Matt, make a note of that word too. Disgusting. Okay, let's underscore some of the takeaways here from this conversation. Go ahead.
And so this is what happens. So and Danny, and what I found too is that I presented all this information, and you know me, I'm very factual on all this stuff. I presented not just for the for-profit media, but for the not-for-profit media.
Yeah, that's fascinating too. You know, NPR. The show about the money on NPR. Tell us about that one.
I've been thrown out of, I think, everybody. I think Marketplace Money, I thought I had a shot with, and that's in Los Angeles. But I was turned down, I think, 22 times by them or something like that. I'm kind of a dog in this stuff. But that's the fact of the matter is, so you get, like, the Nightly Business Report, which is sponsored by, say, Wells Fargo and Franklin Templeton. So they're not going to say anything bad about this stuff. Or Marketplace Money, they've got, you know, large mutual fund advertisers, backers. And so the fact of the matter is even the for-profit, not-for-profit media is doing a horrific job.
Yeah, it says here, you know, you say in your book, you say, surprised? I shouldn't have been. Like Nightly Business reports, some major Marketplace Money's major sponsors include Putnam, the Boston-based mutual fund company owned by the giant Canadian firm Power Financial Corporation. Another of their sponsors is Charles Schwab, a major asset manager, which derives much of its income from fees managing mutual funds. So all of these organizations are part of this industry, and they advertise, you know, on these programs in order to what we would call greenwash in environmental terms, to give themselves more credibility, you know, that they're providing a public service for, you know, the public, when in fact, as you go through this book here and you look at all the companies that are listed and you find out about their bankruptcies and their various wheeling and dealing, you know, you don't know who you can trust. The only person you can trust is Catherine Waters sitting across from me, or maybe your news dissector, and certainly Barry James Dyke. I mean, just listen to these numbers, okay? These are executives in the media industry who become symbols of corporate greed as much as the bankers. Philippe Dowman of Viacom, the media giant that brings you The Daily Show, the Colbert Report, and Jersey Shore made $84.5 million in 2010. Les Moonves of CBS, the giant that brings you 60 Minutes, made $56.9 million. Michael White of DirecTV, $32.9 million. Brian Roberts of Comcast, who now owns 51% of NBC Universal, made $28.2 million. Bob Iger of Disney, $28 million. Jeffrey Bukes of Time Warner, $26.1 million. Glenn Britt of Time Warner Cable, $17.3 million. And our old friend Rupert Murdoch, the billionaire owner of News Corp, took down $16.8 million. Of course, that's just in salary because he also owns a tremendous amount of the stock of the company. So these figures only talk about salaries and compensation, not stock ownership. But, you know, you see a transfer of wealth, you know, and the more we watch, in a way, the more they make. And that's one of those things we don't really think about, how media companies profit on us and why, as a result, they dumb down the news and try to ignore important stories because it brings in bigger audiences, they think. They think the American people don't want to know, or maybe they just don't want to tell us what's really going on. And this is what is really, you know, frightening. And I speak about this not just on the basis of being some sort of a lefty, pinko, commie, radical, you know, vegetarian. I speak about it because I worked on the inside. At CNN, ABC News, CNBC. I observed up close and personal what was actually happening, what stories got covered, what stories didn't get covered, and how they got covered. And that's why it seems to me it's so important. And your book here offers such a brilliant analysis of all this and so much information about it. And it's funny, like you showed me how you can find out who owns media companies very easily on a website called Yahoo Finance. Yeah. Tell us how that works.
Well, that's the whole funny thing, Diddy. Everyone thinks I'm going to be nuts, but within 5 minutes I can show you or anyone really in this country how any company, media company, or Cisco or Apple, any of these companies, they're all owned essentially by institutional investors. In 1970, about 70% of the companies were owned by institutional investors. Today it's roughly 70%. And the majority of those institutional investors are mutual fund companies. And where do they get their money from? Joe Sixpack, if you will. And this is the tragedy. And Danny, you know, I've been exposed to really wealthy people in my lifetime, and you have as well. And none of the people actually, you know, put their money in all this risky stuff, but they're using essentially every man's savings to take control of the empire.
You know, and this is something that, you know, so almost the biggest crimes are right in front of our face. We just don't know what they are. You know, like you showed me to go to Yahoo Finance website, and when you get on there, you put the name of a company in there, and then it says who owns what.
The major shareholders.
Who are the major shareholders? And you click on that, and lo and behold, there they are, all these mutual fund operators in the mutual fund industry who are, in essence, owning these companies. And one of the things you don't see on the air often are, you know, exposés of mutual fund companies. I wonder why. Okay.
I wonder why. Not even in the Times, Danny.
And here you have a chart, media companies with major ownership by mutual funds and institutions. You know, it's fascinating, okay? CBS, 90% of shares held by mutual funds and institutions. Comcast, 83%. Walt Disney, 69%. Gannett, 94%. General Electric, 52%. McClatchy, 95%. Media General, only 9%. You know, so when you, New York Times, 65%. Washington Post, 65%. So you see that these companies are actually invested in these media companies for more than just to make money from them, but also to add legitimacy to their own other ventures, and also to ensure that these institutions are not going to do anything that they don't want them to do in terms of investigating what they're doing. And so all of this is in this book, and I think you alone are one of the few people who've really looked at, as you look at banks, as you look at investment companies, also look at media companies. You make that connection, which many people who don't do it all. I mean, in a sense, when you look at coverage of the media, you know, what they cover is, you know, this program is going to be on Jersey Shore, you know, is having this problem. It's all about stuff for popular entertainment, but not business analysis of what their strategies are, why they're doing what they do, and how that affects us. I was thinking about this the other day, Barry, because in England last week, the awards of British, British television awards came out. And, you know, that's the land of the BBC, of Channel 4, of all the great news organizations. And Al Jazeera English was their top choice for the best news in the world in England, okay? Al Jazeera English. And the Peabody Awards in New York back in the mid-January gave one of their documentary awards to Al Jazeera English. But unless you live maybe in one of three or four places in America, you can't see Al Jazeera English because none of these media companies have it on, you know, and you ask them, well, why is that? And they said, well, our viewers think that Al Jazeera means Al Qaeda because they both have an A at the beginning of the, you know, of the name, you know. I mean, it's preposterous. It's absurd. But nevertheless, years later, a company that's been in business for more than a decade that's providing international news that gets all the top awards from other journalists, okay, can't be seen or heard in the United States. And I think this is why, for example, outfits like Al Jazeera, RT, Russia Today, Press TV, BBC, you know, have followings among Americans who are totally dissatisfied with the news and information that they're getting. So, Barry, as you look at all of this and you go through all of this, I mean,
yep.
You've been writing this book for several years. This is, you know, the second edition or number two.
Yeah.
Do you see anything getting better or getting worse?
Well, you know, I was listening to your previous program. I don't know. It has to get the Federal Reserve is at the heart of all this problem, of course.
Let's go into what the Fed's relationship is to this, because one of the articles I read last night on a website called BaselineScenario.com, which is a economics forum, you have an article there talking about how the Fed has been totally silent about its ideas about financial reform.
Yeah.
You know, and that there's less transparency in the Fed today than ever. And, you know, our next guest, Gary Weiss, is going to talk about Alan Greenspan, who is a big fan of Ayn Rand, who ran, the Fed for all those years. But tell us about the Fed. What role they play in all of this?
Well, you know, it's a private central bank. You know, it's got as much in common with the federal government as Federal Express does. You know, it's a private corporation, and you know, they're causing inflation because there's nothing to back it up. And essentially, the Fed works for the banks and not for the American people. And if people don't believe me, just open up your wallet, look at a dollar. It's not a dollar. It's actually a Federal Reserve note, and it's just paper money. And so they're at the heart of all this, Danny. And so what I really see essentially is what we're starting to see now is, you know, higher food. Of course, they exclude things like food and energy from your core inflation. And so what do I see? I don't have a crystal ball, Danny, but I think we're going to have to be really going back to more self-reliance, because I don't count on the government on any of this stuff. And it doesn't really matter whether Democrat or Republican. It's all about the money. And so what I really think what people have to do is be really more self-reliant, more spiritually, mentally, and physically fit, because none of this stuff is good. I mean, we borrow 43 cents of every dollar we spend.
All right, so listen, let me just we're running out of time on this segment. Unfortunately, we're just getting started, and we're running out of time. We're going to have you back, Barry, because you have so much to offer. But just tell people how they can get this book, because it's really a must-read.
Yeah, it's exclusively available off my website, thepiratesofmanhattan.com. Again, that's www.thepiratesofmanhattan.com. Eventually, I'll have it up on Amazon, whatever. But for right now, just off the thepiratesofmanhattan.com, and then eventually there'll be an ebook as well. But just getting this thing together, Danny, was a ton of work.
Well,
you're
on Facebook at the Pirates of Manhattan as well. Gary, on the phone, I believe. Are you still there? Hello?
Hello?
Yeah. Yeah, Gary, did you have a question or something you wanted to shoot in here?
Me? No, I didn't.
Oh, my guest. Gary, sorry. I'm confused. Forgive me. Gary, we'll be with you in a minute.
Sure.
Barry, to Gary, to Danny, back to you, the listener. We'll be back in a moment here on News Dissector Radio on PRN-FM. Stay with me.
Got free money, but you have to pay. Got free money, but you have to pay.
Shop till you drop.
The American way. Got free money, but you have to pay.
From the sea to the shining sea.
Got free money, but you have to pay.
Signing up for bankruptcy.
Got free.
In the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
It's corrupt!
Something's wrong in America!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. Whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game.
It's corrupt!
Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
It's
Something's Wrong in America. That's from an Occupy song by Polarity One. We feature his music on this program every week. Gary Weiss, author of Ayn Rand Nation, is joining us just in a second. Gary, if you just don't mind, Catherine has a couple of announcements of some events coming up.
I just wanted to announce I have a small flyer here. This Sunday, February 26th at 2 p.m., Occupy Wall Street and the Vagina Monologues with Eve Ensler. Again, that's Sunday, February 26th at 2 o'clock at the Great Hall at Cooper Union, which is 7 East 7th Street. And all proceeds are going to benefit the National Alliance of Domestic Workers and the Voices of Women Organizing Project. VOW, Until the Violence Stops. For more information, www.vday.org. And then also this evening, Friday, 7:45 p.m., Behind the Swoosh, Jim Keady, who's been battling Nike sweatshops in Indonesia, is going to be giving an inspirational talk at the Catholic Worker. Location 55 East 3rd Street. You can look up Facebook Behind the Swoosh. Again, that's 7:45 p.m. this evening. The Catholic Worker, 55 East 3rd Street. That's off of 2nd Avenue here in New York City.
Well, we had Jim on the other week here on the News Dissector Radio. He's brilliant. He's anecdotal. He's passionate. He's the real thing. He's an activist organizer. If you don't know about his work, he's a former soccer coach at St. John's University who got fired because of his protest about the use of Nike dominating the athletics program at St. John's, and he's somebody certainly worth seeing. Gary Weiss, you've been writing about the financial crisis. You've been exposing various injustices, but now you've done something different. You've taken a look at the philosophy or a philosophical strand, a philosophical approach that has really helped transform the country and in some ways responsible for the Tea Party, in your view, has led to the justification of all kinds of Wall Street crime and basically ignoring it because of higher values. And a lot of this is associated with Ayn Rand, who was a very has been a very popular writer. Her books, Fountainhead and Atlas Shrugged, are very well known. But you look into this, and not just as a book review or as a personality profile or a biography, but as a phenomenon.
Yeah.
And how this has affected us, this belief in unfettered capitalism, unregulated business, bare bones government providing no social services, a glorification of selfishness, a disdain for Judeo-Christian morality. These are the tenets of her philosophy, and yet they seem to have really caught on with a lot of people. So tell us a little bit about what got you into looking into this phenomenon, what you found.
Well, Danny, actually, I was originally thinking of looking at Alan Greenspan and his impact on the mess that we got in, his role.
The maestro.
The maestro, the godfather of the financial crisis, so to speak.
But he's one of those guys who, like William Casey at the CIA, you know, would give testimony by mumbling, you know?
Mm.
You wouldn't really be able to say, what is he saying? It sounds so brilliant. You know?
Delphic.
Yeah, go ahead. Sorry.
He was Delphic.
Yeah, Delphic.
Was and is Delphic. But, you know, the more I looked into Greenspan, it was really, what you're looking at really is Ayn Rand, because Ayn Rand was the major influence on his life philosophically for 30 years. And as I dug into Greenspan, I found things that really astounded me. I found that really Rand had sort of been speaking, had been acting through Greenspan. I call Greenspan the Murray Hill candidate, you know, sort of like the the Manchurian candidate.
Marionette, maybe.
Marionette. Well, Rand used to meet with her. You know, with her acolytes and this little cult-like thing in Murray Hill in her apartment on East 36th.
What was it called again? That they had a name for it.
Yeah, it was called the Collective. You know, they used that jocularly, you know, because they were not—they didn't believe in being collective, supposedly. But Greenspan was a deputy. He was not just a follower of Rand, but he was a deputy to her. He was like number two and three in the organization, so to speak. For many years.
And he brought her into the White House. I mean, you talk about a photograph that got you interested in this of Ayn Rand standing next to Alan Greenspan.
Yeah. I was really fascinated by this photograph that was taken in 1974 when he was sworn in as head of the Council on Economic Advisers. He was appointed by Nixon and sworn in under Ford. And there she is right next to Greenspan in the Oval Office. And that got me really fascinated. That got me first looking into Greenspan, and then, you know, gee, it just all boiled down. It just all came down to Rand.
Now tell me about her, because what's her background, and how did she emerge as this kind of force? When I was at college back in the day, so to speak, back in the 60s, there were all these acolytes, you know, Young Americans for Freedom, who couldn't get enough of her books and who were worshipping her, basically.
Oh, sure. Yeah, no, she was very big in the 60s. Very big today. Bigger, I would say bigger today than she was then. Well, Rand came from Russia. You know, she had a, you know, sort of a troubled background in Russia. She sort of saw Russia when, right after the revolution, at a time when, there were excesses. You know, the excesses were really burned into her consciousness. And she was an illegal immigrant, actually, to the U.S. She emigrated to the U.S. illegally on a student visa, the way many people have done since then.
I wonder if they would demand her self-deportation if she was still alive.
Oh.
You know, Newt Gingrich could place her under house arrest, you know.
Yeah.
I doubt it very much, though.
Yeah, probably not. But she came to this country. She started writing novels. You know, look, she was a reasonably good novelist in her early days. She wrote, books that were reasonably good narratives. You know, I interviewed Oliver Stone, who is certainly no Ayn Rand acolyte, and we had a really interesting conversation. He was very impressed with Rand as a writer. Certainly in the Fountainhead.
He was going to make remake the movie, right?
He was going to remake the Fountainhead, and toward the end of the book, I get into some of his ideas as to what people can do with Rand's philosophy to make them palatable. You know, it is sort of jujitsu. You know, what you can do with Rand's philosophy to benefit the progressive cause. I thought that was one of the more interesting interviews.
Well, I think what's also interesting about your approach was that you didn't start out here just to trash her.
No.
You actually respect, you know, some of her talent, but you also weave it into a larger critical framework, which I think gives the book so much more credibility. And you subtitled this book, The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that what you're seeing right now is a struggle. You certainly see it in the Republican primaries. You see this big assault on progressive values, this assault on government, What kind of government are we going to have? Are we even going to have a government if you're a Ron Paul advocate? There is this unprecedented, virtually unprecedented assault on the role of government in our life. And what kind of government do we have? Are we going to have a government that takes care of people? Here you have Rand speaking, because Rand did not believe that government should take care of the poor, take care of the old. And that was because at the bottom of her philosophy was the belief that we're sort of all islands, you know, no man is an island was not her philosophy. She believed that people should be selfish, that selfish was not only the right way to behave, it was the only moral way to behave. And moreover, she made selfishness into a cult, and she made selfishness to be cool.
You know,
in her book, The Fountainhead.
You know, there's a saying, you know, if you're not for yourself, who will be for you?
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the second phrase, you know, if you're only for yourself, you know.
Yeah, if you're only for yourself, then who, then what are you?
Yeah.
That was Maimonides, I think.
Exactly. I mean, in your sum up of this, I mean, you're talking about her philosophy, objectivism, would lead to no government except the police, courts of law, and armed services, no regulation of anything by any government, no Medicare or Medicaid, no Social Security, no public schools, no public hospitals, no public anything.
Yeah.
Now, is that a fair sum up of her essential beliefs?
Yeah, well, that's precisely what she says. She doesn't believe in. Well, I mean, don't forget there'd be no child labor laws. I've seen objectivists go into these long rants into how child labor laws are not necessary. No labor. You know, they did favor labor unions, and that I think is the only exception to their general advocacy of basically destroying the fabric of what institutions that you have in this country to protect working people.
But what I found so fascinating here, Gary, was, you know, you didn't just write about her in the third person. You actually reached out to the people who are in the inner circle, so to speak. You tried to interview them. You tried to talk to them. At first, they pushed you away. They wouldn't respond to your emails. But you were relentless in trying to, you know, talk to them. And many of them did agree to talk to you. What was her world like, her people like?
Well, I was really sort of surprised. You know, as you point out, you know, I wanted to just find out what these people were like. I attended Ayn Rand meetings. They were not unpleasant meetings. These are interesting people. They're not fanatics. They're not even really cultists. Now, that was a big surprise to me. But they do sincerely believe that we shouldn't have the kind of institutions that we have. You know, I think it's important to get to understand why people think the way they do, and that's sort of what I set out to do. So I attended these meetings, and I spoke to the head of the Ayn Rand Institute. He finally talked to me, and it was, I think, to me, it was a fascinating experience because it wasn't what I expected. And I talked to the people in the Tea Party who believe very firmly in Rand, and it was what I found is that they got something from Rand more than just the capitalism. Rand was like, she was like a self-help guru to a large extent.
And she herself had, like, attitudes that were pretty adventurous in some terms of marriage.
Oh,
in terms,
yeah.
You know, in terms of social conventions. Isn't that the case?
Well, absolutely. Now, she was, first of all, you know, she took certain positions. So it's a little bit like Ron Paul to this extent, that she took positions that might be considered progressive today, for instance. She was very much in favor of abortion. She refused to endorse Reagan in 1980 because of his opposition to abortion, because of his alliance with the religious right. So there were certain things she took some interesting positions. She was against the Vietnam War. She was also against World War II, though. You know, she was, you know, she took positions that were very interesting and reasonable, but then she followed them to the nth degree, to the point that they were unreasonable.
And one of the people that you ended up talking with was a woman who I've met, who I find extremely distasteful, Pamela Geller,
who
was the leader of the, you know, of the mobs against the Ground Zero Mosque, and who was like a fanatically anti-Islamic in a way. So, what do you make of her? Because she was like also a big Atlas Shrugged person, right?
Oh, exactly. Yeah, she's a very big Rand person, which is, I noticed, something that the media has tended to neglect. I think it's interesting to find out why does a person believe the way she does. What's their opinion? Geller interested me because she was interested in Rand. She got interested in Rand because of what I was just describing. Rand appealed to her because Rand, you know, she was like a rebel in her family. You know, it wasn't the capitalism that appealed to her from Rand. It was the fact that Rand, she was a rebel in her family, and Rand told, you know, sort of taught her, you know, reading these books, taught her to stand up against her family.
So she was
it was kind of
her role model, if you will.
Yeah, sort of role model. But then from there, you see, then Rand spoke to her in terms of the other aspects of the philosophy. And, of course, Rand was also, she was very pro-Israel. There was that aspect. But I think that was secondary in terms of Rand and her views on Islam and whatever. I think it was secondary that what really appealed to her about Rand was the sort of what I call the big book aspect of it. You know, it's almost like a self-help manual.
She also, Glenn Beck was a big Rand person, isn't he?
He's a big Rand person. And what's surprising about Beck, or maybe really not surprising, you see a lot of people who love Rand, people like Beck, who are also really religious. And Rand really hated that. Rand would not have appreciated that kind of support. She would not have liked Beck at all.
Yeah, in other words, but on the other hand, she has become a sort of almost a religious icon within this particular world, and people swear by her, worship her in some ways, even if they distort a lot of what she actually believed. And that's why I think your book gives a very nuanced view of her thinking and the followers that she, you know, attracted, many of whom are at war with each other.
Absolutely. There's constant infighting within the Rand ranks. What made Beck sort of interesting, really, if you saw his attacks on social programs, you know, the church supporting social programs, that's straight out of Rand. She really didn't like, she felt that, the aspects of Christianity that supported that supported the poor social programs. She was very much opposed to them, and much of what Beck was saying was straight out of Rand, uncanny.
Well, you know, I mean, I think that this is important because, you know, ideas have ideologies, and they have ideologues, and they have sometimes even philosophers behind them. Marx was a philosopher, certainly. There are people on all sides of different issues who also have the people who inspired them, who they believe, you know, had the ultimate brilliant insights that led them on the path that they've taken. And she certainly is one of those people. And I think it's important when we look at the debate in America over the future of our economy, the conflict, if you will, between Occupy Wall Street and the Tea Party, the debates that are underway right now. Her values are very much part of all of this, and your serious effort to treat all of this with not only nuanced analysis, but really quite informed and interesting writing, I must say, Gary. I was very taken with this book.
Well, thank you, Danny.
And, you know, I really recommend, to our listeners that they get this book, Ayn Rand. I keep calling her Anne, but it's not really Anne, is it?
Well, sometimes pronounced Ayn.
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 Like Heil.
Ayn.
Ayn.
Right. Ayn. Ayn Rand. St. Martin's Press. I'm glad a saint is involved in
Ayn Rand Nation.
In bringing your book out. Yeah. Ayn Rand Nation, mm-hmm. The Hidden Struggle for America's Soul, Gary Weiss. Gary, is there a website or a place people can reach you?
Well, you can go to my author website. It's gary-weiss.com.
Well, please do, and I want to really express my appreciation. I know the book is really coming out next week, and this is an earlier interview, but I'm really happy that you agreed to come on. I have a great deal of admiration for your work and your convictions, your willingness to take on subjects like this that other people would just sort of dismiss, perhaps, because they would find themselves on the other side of the spectrum, but take it seriously and really kind of teach us something new about it, which is what this book does, and thank you so much for joining us on News Dissector Radio.
Oh, my pleasure, Danny.
Well, there you go. We've had two brilliant authors today talking about the economy. We've told you about some events that are coming up. You seem to be grimacing, Catherine, when he was criticizing her. Is it because you, you know, are a big worshiper of her work?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I actually wanted to, or I hope to interject, you know, like everything in moderation and, you know, like her philosophy of, you know, just selfishness or, you know, and getting rid of, you know, government helping the poor, I absolutely do not agree with at all. And so...
Well, I'm going to lend you this book. I think you're going to find it very interesting. Thank you, everyone, for joining us here on News Dissector Radio. Once again, there's going to be a podcast available of this program that you can listen to and share with your friends. It'll be on the PRN.FM website. It will also be on the blog, newsdissector.net, and you'll be able to listen to that. You can write to me at dissector@mediachannel.org. Our media channel now, the media channel that you can check out that's online, that hasn't been hacked and sabotaged, is mediachannel1.org, and we're trying to feature some of the most interesting writing and reporting about the media on that, and I'm going to be writing something about this book by both of these books as a commentary, hopefully, that Al Jazeera will run, because I think it's an extremely important effort. The blog, again, is now at newsdissector.net, you know, which is a daily effort at dissecting the news, offering a counter narrative and the rest. We're very pleased to be on Progressive Radio Network because we're able to reach more people, and we're really pleased with the support of Gary Knoll and his team here, who have done, Jason and Matt and the rest of the people here, who have done such a good job in bringing this radio station to more and more listeners every week. There's a new website. It's either up or it's soon to be up. Is it up? It's up. March 1st, new website. New website, sorry, PRN.FM. Check it out. Thank you for being here. We'll be back next week with more, I hope. Incidentally, I've been invited to speak in Geneva, Switzerland at a UN NGO hearing, and I'm going to be talking about human rights and the financial crisis. That's coming up in mid-March, and I'll tell you more about that as well. I just got the ticket today to go, so I'm ready to go. Catherine is just coming back from Geneva, so we can trade notes there about the best chocolate in Switzerland. Thank you for joining us. See you next week.
We're soft and smooth.
The world in a minute.
The station carries no news of the world.
Corporate America owns all the networks.
Freedom of the press is only guaranteed when you own the press.
Communication breakdown. Pause for the message breakup. Every station is identification. Global syndication is the shaping of the nation. ABC, Disney, NBC, GE, Murder gets Foxy, and with a hint, he owns a pen. The camera, the sword, buy a Coke, buy a Ford, getting broke, getting bored.
And experience your psychic connection.
We don't have shit to say, we don't have anything to do.
Selling attitude like food for the masses. Junk consumption, we are lumping. Just a bumpkin to the corporate state. You can't satiate what you can't negotiate. Your will's been snatched, the bill's attached. Flim flam diagram, data jam, handicap caught it. Yo, you bought it. My mind is a profitable thing to waste. You want another taste, baby? Got news, goo.
What we need to know.
News, goo.
What we want to know.
News, goo.
What we think we know.
Got remote control to choose the show. But the more we watch, the less we know. Ignorance grows on the spirit like a tumor.
Till freedom is a rumor.
Elvis Presley.
O.J. Simpson abandoned Baden.
Order now.
What we want, what we need, what we want, what we need. But do we even know who plans to see? You think the media works for you, but it's a job for them. They're just selling proof. Who owns media? Who does it speak for? Your butt's on the sofa, your mind's at the door. And that's what entertainment's for. It's a drug of the century, the soul penitentiary.
Did you find you lost your virginity at the same time?
Time is right, and rating pressures.
Sad, what they call a news report. Who's fucking who? OJ in court. News is not supposed to entertain. The drug, the soul, to kill the pain. But it all adds up to someone's capital gain. News, do no explanation. We're lost in the field of information plantation.
Coming back after station identification.
News, do
what we need to know.
News.